bounds by eight. Oh, they call it the other way. And now there's a steal by Bird. Underneath the DJ, late snap. Right at 1 second left. What a play by Bird. Bird stole the inbounding pass. Laid it up to DJ. DJ laid it up and in. And Boston has a 1 point lead with 1 second left. Oh my, this place has gone crazy.
17 seconds from game seven, or from championship number six. Jordan, open. Chicago with the lead. Timeout, Utah. 5.2 seconds left. Michael Jordan running on fumes with 45 points.
At the end of the game, you gotta get it out of his hands. Jordan frees himself.
No timeouts here now. A 1 point game. Walton can tip it. Bryant with the save.
Now you gotta get a shot here.
Final seconds. Bryant for the win. Bang!
It is Thursday, October 24th. It is late right now. It is 8:15 here in Columbia, Missouri. The Milwaukee Bucks, my Milwaukee Bucks, are playing in Game 1 of 82 against the Houston Rockets. Should be a pretty good game. It's close right now. I know that much. But I'm in the studio because I want to record. And I have been fortunate to have athletes come on the show. I've been fortunate to have writers come on the show. I've been fortunate to have a little bit of everything. And of all the guests I've ever had, this might be the most nervous I have ever been for having a guest on. And I'll explain here in a little bit. Today coming on the Bo Templin Show is Tim Gallagher. Tim Gallagher is an NBA historian like any other that I have ever come across in my days of basketball. And I think it's important to know that, you know, Tim lives down the street from me in San Diego. Tim and my dad are very good, close friends. Tim has shaped my basketball life. And that is, you know, no BS. That is the truth. Tim grew up in Ohio. He attended Archbishop High School with Jim Paxson. And he's got a fantastic story of his own. Tim became a basketball nut almost 50 years ago. 1968, 1969 was a pivotal season for him, and that was the University of Dayton going to the Final Four. That basketball program for Tim was larger than life. At the age of 10, he started collecting autographs with a couple of other hood childhood friends, and I'm not going to put the specific number on, but I can conservatively say he has well over 20,000 autographs. And you know, for a lot of people, that probably shocks them. Oh, what a large number. That's not the impressive part. The impressive part for Tim, and I'm going to struggle with this for most of the podcast because for my whole life, it's been Mr. Gallagher. But for this, I'm going to try and call him Tim. Tim has over 20,000 autographs, but what's cool about the autographs is that they're personalized. They're specific. They say to Tim, and they come from a memory. They come from a greeting. They come from a handshake. They come from attending a game at a specific arena. He is a true historian, and he connects the dots unlike any other. I take a lot of pride in my basketball knowledge. I take a lot of pride in my father's basketball knowledge. And there are times where my dad, myself, and Tim are speaking, and we cannot keep up with what Tim is saying. He is that good. He is that knowledgeable about the game. He is the professor. And so what we're going to do today is a little bit of a history lesson. You name a player, Tim's got something on him. And this collection that he has of autographs, it's staggering. But it's the relationships formed. It's the memories that he has created. And one of the relationships that he's created is with my dad. And it's deeper than the players. It's the magazine cover that he leaves on our front door, circling a pair of shoes, or circling the shoelaces used on a pair of Adidas back in 1967. Back in 84, he has the shoes circled. He has an arena label. He has an advertisement sign. And it's all about the details. It's about visiting historic arenas. It's the Hinkle Fieldhouse, where the last scene of Hoosiers is filmed. He has attended over 20 Final Fours, countless NCAA regional games. And I mean, since I've started playing basketball, Tim was one of my coaches, one of my earliest on coaches. And for one of my teams, and this is a memory as sharp as any other, Tim had coach John Wooden, the legend, the absolute cream of the crop, the Mount Rushmore, one of the greatest basketball minds, one of the greatest leadership minds we've ever seen. He had John Wooden sign autographs personalized of the Pyramid of Success to each member of that team. I still have that Pyramid of Success at my house. So this means a lot to me. When I was older, you know, it was Tim's relationship with, you know, well-known shooting coach Chip Engold, who he gave me a shooting lesson. And it was Chip Engold who helped Kawhi's jumper and turned Kawhi into the player today. When we were growing up watching Kawhi at San Diego State, that was not the same player that you see today. So, coming on the show today, it is my absolute honor. I am nervous, I'm sweating, I'm shaking right now because this does mean so much to me. Tim, thank you for coming on to the show today.
Well, thank you, Bo, for that fantastic information and introduction. And I think you can just relax and be the cool customer like you were at the free throw line when I saw you playing ball, man. Just relax and knock them down, which you usually did. So
I appreciate that a great deal. And it was the truth, though. So what we decided to do today is when I reached out to you, we said that we weren't sure exactly. We were working out the kinks on this conversation. And how it started, though, was players perhaps getting crowned too young of an age, and the NBA is so youth-heavy right now that I came up with a list of 10 players that I thought we would go through, and we would call this a history lesson. You're the professor, and you're here to teach us that, you know, these guys have been around before, right? We've seen players like this before. So we have a list of 10, and then you have a list of, you know, a couple guys on your own that we'll run through, maybe a slight player analysis, player comparison, and a breakdown of the game. And we'll talk maybe about how the game has changed over the years since you started as a fan. And the first name that I wanted to come up with is Devin Booker. Devin Booker is as unique of a scorer as we see in the NBA. At a very young age, he's already putting up 70-point games. He has a very interesting use of his game. He can let it fly from deep. He's crafty around the hoop. But he also uses the mid-range. So, Tim, who have we seen before that Devin Booker's game is a lot like?
Sure. Well, and let me preface as we go through these that I love the game more than ever, and the game has evolved, and even though I kind of have an old-school foundation for my original love of the game and players from yesteryear, I have a total appreciation for the talent, athleticism, shooting ability, the pace and space, wide-open freedom of today's NBA and even to an extent college game. So I don't want the listeners to think, oh, he's living in the past and he's not seeing where the game's evolving. So I want to put that out as a disclaimer right away. But I think also a lot of players from the past are kind of overlooked and forgotten. And so maybe some of these names I mentioned will cause the listeners to do a little research. There's YouTube footage on these players and a way to kind of maybe look back and gain a little appreciation of history. So with someone like Devin Booker, and I think he's a very key representative of what I think part of the problem is with today's analysis and praise of players, because sure, he's put up some big games. I know his 70-point game against the Celtics was in a loss, which I know that can happen, but you know, the Suns have not been successful as a team since he's been there. They've not been in the playoffs. So part of my value of a player is winning. And I'm not talking just championships. I'm talking a winning culture, you know, leading teams to the playoffs and maybe a round or two into the playoffs. You know, championships are a pretty lofty perch to get to. So I'm not, you know, hanging it just on that. But, you know, and I think also, some of these players like a Devin Booker, who's very talented and seems like a very hard worker and solid citizen, but he only played 1 year in college at Kentucky. So in terms of just maturity and leadership, it doesn't equate to his talent, right? So that's where there's a little bit of a disconnect, I think, in terms of how some of these players are looked at. But
do you think he has that gene in him to be an alpha male leader that I would think, you know, most basketball teams need?
I think he does. You know, his father, Melvin Booker, and Bo, as I'm talking to you in Columbia, Missouri, his father played at Missouri and was a very good player and an NBA player, Melvin Booker. So I think, you know, that's a very key ingredient to a lot of success that we see in players today. You know, Klay Thompson, Steph Curry are very, very obvious examples of guys we see all the time who are sons of NBA players. So I think Devin Booker's been exposed to, you know, NBA life from probably since he was almost born. So I think all the ingredients are there. It's just you know, expecting a, and I don't have it right in front of me in my fingertips, but he's probably what, 23, maybe 24 at the most. I don't know if he's even that, you know, that old, right? So to expect that person to be the leader of your team and, you know, kind of police things in the locker room and, you know, take leadership other than just by performance on the court, I think it's a lot to ask, right? And
Devin Booker, by the way, Tim, is younger than I am, or excuse me, he is older than me by 2 months.
Wow.
He's 22 years old.
Right. So think about that, right? If you were thrust onto an NBA roster and had the talent to play, and that mix of
that's a big if. That's a big if right there.
Yeah, but the mix of players on that roster, right, where you've got, you know, 10-year veterans, guys in their early 30s that are fighting for their lives to keep a job, right? And so you have to defer or, you know, listen to somebody that's 10 years younger than you. You know, it's an interesting dynamic, right? Not impossible, but, you know, again, I think that's part of the strange mix that kind of goes on a lot of these teams. But – anyway, enough of the preamble. Let's get to the player. So the player that I immediately thought of, and I tried not to overthink this and, you know, just to go through my mental Rolodex, and the player that I thought of with Devin Booker is Allen Houston, who probably a lot of people remember him as a New York Knick and, you know, a very talented player and, you know, maybe just a little shy of Hall of Fame credentials, but you know, possibly could get in. Played also with the Pistons with Grant Hill early on in his career. Had a fantastic college career at the University of Tennessee. So he was a similar player to Booker and, you know, kind of silky, known for his shooting. Of course, when Allen Houston played, the three-pointer was there, but not like it is today where it was the preferred shot. But I think in kind of the physicality of these players, you know, their size, their kind of their look, I tried to find the comparison, not only with, you know, kind of how they play, but the other variables like that as well. So I think Devin Booker could have a, you know, a near Hall of Fame career, maybe a Hall of Fame career if he keeps evolving. But again, until he starts playing on some winning teams, we see the Suns in the playoffs, I'm a little concerned. And I'm not putting it all on his shoulders, right, just because of his limited experience as a player, despite the talent. And there's a number of players on the list or players like that that I think kind of fit in that category. Obviously, Zion Williamson's on everybody's minds right now, although he's injured for a little while. But, again, seems like a great kid, very dynamic, personality-wise as well as talent. But, you know, his 1 year at Duke, they did okay. I know he has, you know, had the injury and everything, but, you know, they didn't get to the Final Four. They didn't win the championship. I know that's hard to do, but again, he's going to have to show me some winning as well, which, you know, again, I'm going to give him a little runway to do that. But that's a key ingredient for me to, you know, as we kind of say, crown these guys, right? I appreciate their talent. I appreciate their ability. I appreciate the career trajectory that they're on. But I want to see winning, kind of like your guy Giannis at Milwaukee, right? Now they're a winning team, you know, best record in the league last year, right? He's on not only that trajectory as a player, but in terms of success on the court and winning and leadership as well.
The next name that I have here on the list is Montrezl Harrell. I'm going to kind of explain how I came up with that name. You know, I'm watching this Lakers-Clippers game on Tuesday, right, the first game of the season. And I've been lucky to catch a couple Clipper games over the last year. And, you know, being a Southern California guy, we're able to watch plenty of Clipper and Laker basketball. One, Harrell reminds me just of an old school guy. I don't know if there's a better motor right now in the league. And I am addicted to guys who have great motors. You know, we've been able to follow Harrell since his days at Louisville. And he's an interesting player. And now for the first time, I think he's on a legit team. And, you know, he didn't have that luxury necessarily early on. He's behind Blake and he's behind DeAndre Jordan. And then last year, you know, obviously the Clippers are an 8 seed and they're a quality basketball team. But this is a whole new ball game. And the reason I'm intrigued by Harrell is that his game doesn't really change now that they're among the big guys, right? Now that they're the top 2-3 teams in the league, things don't really have to change for him. So what do you see in Montrezl Harrell?
Yeah, well, I'll give a couple of names that come to mind first. The first obvious example is Ben Wallace. So,
I like that.
Pistons teams, right, where kind of a guy that does the dirty work, you know, kind of a physical specimen, you know, a tough guy, kind of an enforcer, you know, don't mess with me kind of guy. You know, and the thing that's kind of evolved, too, is a guy like Montrezl Harrell in today's NBA can play at the five, right, where in the old days he would have definitely strictly been a four. Right, whereas the game has gone smaller and spaced out, a guy like him can be a five. Another name that came to mind too, besides Ben Wallace, is Otis Thorpe, who was a really talented power forward for the Kings and for the Rockets back in the day. He played at Providence and again kind of had that physique like Montrezl Harrell, where just, you know, an Adonis type body and you know, just kind of controlled the paint, but not a scorer, and, you know, kind of, you know, was more a defense and rebound first kind of guy. Didn't play with the energy like Montrezl Harrell plays with. You know, Ben Wallace was maybe more of that, had that kind of a motor. You know, the other thing with Montrezl Harrell is, you know, his body is kind of like a Karl Malone as well. He doesn't have the offensive skill set of a Karl Malone, but, you know, just you can't teach a motor like Montrezl Harrell has. And I got to tell you, when he played at Louisville, I never would have projected him to be this good of an NBA player. You know, I could see him as a roster guy, you know, and kind of how he was in the first few years in the league, where he'd come off the bench and maybe provide a little energy, some rebounding, but not as a, you know, as a high rotation guy, starter, key guy on a team that could possibly, you know, challenge for a championship. I mean, you know, I love the way he plays, love the way he finishes around the rim, and, you know, just a fearless, tough player. But it kind of also makes me wonder, when he was at Louisville and Donovan Mitchell at Louisville, you know, I follow college basketball just like you, and I remember them as players, but did Patino kind of not know what he had in those guys? I mean, they were just good players, or, you know, maybe they just evolved and progressed enough that now that they're in the NBA and have more freedom, they're potential all-stars, or Donovan Mitchell is already there. But it's kind of interesting at Louisville that they didn't show me this kind of ability.
Mitchell, we've seen a lot of growth, I think, from his days in college to now. I think the biggest difference, though, with Harrell is the role changed, right? In college, he's supposed to be this he was a huge recruit, and he was supposed to be this great player, and he was expected to do so much. And that wasn't really ever his game, right? You keep him in a limited, and when I say a limited role, I don't want to decrease his value by any means, but you put him in a role where all he has to do is sprint the floor, rebound, and defend. Well, oh my goodness, now you're talking about a great recipe for a guy like that. The next name that I have here on my list, Tim, Kevin Knox. Now, we've talked a bit on my podcast about Kevin Knox, and the reason is, Kevin Knox was really close to coming to Mizzou. We did an NBA season preview last week, and we talked about Kevin Knox. He almost came to Mizzou. He ended up not and went to Kentucky instead. So when he came to Kentucky and they traveled to Mizzou to play at Mizzou Arena, he got booed hard. It was a brutal atmosphere for Kevin Knox. And he struggled mightily in this game. I'm telling you, mightily. Probably – If you asked him, I would imagine today, if you asked him about his game at Mizzou, he would recall not playing well. But I think he's set up to have a great couple seasons in New York. Now, I know the organization's dysfunctional, but I have a lot of faith and belief in his game, and I think he's going to kind of take that step-by-step year where by year four or five, he's going to be a pretty elite ball player. What do you think?
Well, I'm definitely intrigued by his talent. You kind of touched on it a little bit with the Knicks organization is not a real breeding ground for success, you know, for a young player. Again, you kind of, you know, you used to see it back in the day with the Clippers or a franchise like Sacramento, and both of those franchises, especially the Clippers, are, you know, on a much better path now. And, you know, their young players seem to be developing and improving, and, you know, the culture of losing isn't, you know, kind of bringing everybody down. I think the Knicks have not broken through in that way in terms of the culture and, you know, providing that path for a player like Knox to really blossom. A player from the past that he kind of reminds me of a little bit is a guy named Nick Anderson, who probably best known for playing on the Orlando Magic teams with Shaq and Penny Hardaway, and was a very, very solid NBA player. He sadly is kind of remembered for missing a couple key free throws against the Rockets in the finals that kind of cost the Magic a series. And I mean, that's a little bit of a heavy burden to put on a guy, but it was that pivotal of a couple of misses. But aside from that, had a very solid NBA career, played at University of Illinois, you know, all Big Ten guy. You know, some other players, you know, I know it's a little close to home with a Nick comparison, but Carmelo Anthony, I see a little Carmelo in Kevin Knox's game, right, where, you know, he's kind of got that size and he can step out and shoot the ball. But I would say the jury's still out on him. And again, another guy that just 1 year at Kentucky. And again, the 1 year he had at Kentucky, they were good, but not great. And just, you know, he's still got a lot to prove to me, but I think the skill set is there. And I do like his talent. You know, I saw him play in Vegas in the summer league before his rookie season and was impressed by the way he played and, you know, seeing him in person and saw the skill set. So, the jury's still out for me, you know, I think, but, you know, a Nick Anderson level achievement is there. Somebody like Carmelo maybe is a pretty lofty goal to reach, but, you know, I see that kind of skill.
Kevin Knox, I think the biggest difference, though, is early on with Carmelo, the thing that stood out to me during his first 3-4 years in the league was his footwork, right? That was always there. He had that probably since his days at Syracuse even. I don't know if we have that same level of footwork from Kevin Knox. Now, the game is different, right? Melo was able to kind of abuse the footwork and abuse opposing feet by playing at 15 feet in. It sounds like from the sound bites that I'm hearing out in New York that Kevin Knox is trying to step out his game and space the floor and then attack the rim hard. I would love for him to develop and spend time, quality time, on a turnaround jumper kind of from the low post. The next player that I have here for you, Tim, he's a defending champ, Pascal Siakam. He is as unique of a player probably on this list. I would imagine he kind of falls in the Montrezl Harrell lane on the side of things, right? He isn't necessarily just this crazy scorer that we see with the other guys, but insane motor. He has a quality move that he can go to. That spin move going to his right hand is really, really good. And he was abusing that during the Eastern Conference playoffs last year. Pascal Siakam, obviously he's young in his career, as a lot of these guys are on his list. Where do you kind of see his career going?
Well, I really love him. And the thing about a player like him is, you know, just how he's kind of emerged from, you know, somewhat obscurity, right? So he wasn't a McDonald's All-American. He, you know, played at New Mexico State, so not a high-profile school, although, you know, played well there and, you know, had some success. But, you know, not a high lottery-type pick, played in the G League for a little while. So it's been a, you know, he's been humble, right, in terms of, you know, having to play with the chip on his shoulder and prove himself. And, but, yeah, it looked like early on when he started to get minutes, that you could see the talent. A player from the past he kind of reminds me of. So a guy with size that had that kind of versatility and could shoot the ball a little bit was a guy named Rasheed Wallace. So I don't know if you remember him. You know, he was on the Piston championship team with Larry Brown and Chauncey. And
Trailblazer as well, of course.
Blazers. I mean, he was also known for being a little bit of a, you know, temperamental guy and, you know, tended to lead the league in technicals and things like that. So, you know, Siakam.
I recall Rasheed Wallace getting technicals for not saying anything to the ref and just staring at him. That's what I remember about Rasheed Wallace.
Right. But, yeah, but he was, you know, 6'11 and can move like Siakam, right? Siakam is very fluid and can run the court, handle the ball. And Rasheed Wallace, again, played in a little different era. I mean, he did have the green light to shoot threes, but he was one of the few, you know, really big guys that successfully did that, where today it's almost a requirement for guys of his size. But another player he reminds me of, and not, goes back a little further, but a guy named Sam Perkins. Now, Sam Perkins was a lefty and played at North Carolina with Jordan and long time in the NBA, Dallas, Lakers, Pacers, a couple different teams. But he was kind of also, you know, long and athletic and affected the game on the defensive end and, you know, didn't really make many mistakes and, you know, just a solid all-around player. Siakam plays with a little more speed and energy than Perkins, and that's why the Wallace comparison, I think, is a little better. But I think this will be a real interesting year for Siakam in that with Kawhi gone and the Raptors having a little different roster. So the leap he made, you know, going into last season, which was a big one, I think for them to really be a challenger to go anywhere in the playoffs, he's going to have to take it even another notch, which I think he's very capable of doing.
The next... Okay, so I have two names here, and they're both on the same team, so I'm going to kind of bunch them together because I don't really necessarily know what separates these two, and I want to see what your thoughts are because it's a great basketball city. They're clearly talented players, but last season didn't go that well, and this year is kind of up in limbo a little bit in a very top-heavy East. It's Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. And, you know, you hear the Tatum-Kobe thing a lot just because they work together. But Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, you don't necessarily need to compare them as a duo, but I'm just going to kind of bunch them together just because they're in the same setting and atmosphere.
Right. Yeah, well, of the two, I definitely like Tatum more. And I think his star potential, actually in his case, superstar potential is definitely there. But we'll get to him in a second. So with Jaylen Brown, also a very intriguing talent. I remember at draft night, though, I was surprised he went so high. But Danny Ainge is pretty shrewd and knows what he's doing, I think, from a talent evaluation standpoint. The players I compare Jaylen Brown to are a guy that just recently retired from the NBA, which is Richard Jefferson, who I know you've seen play Bo in those secret pickup games, which will be a story for another podcast sometime. But
yes, we will save that.
Another guy, Jason Richardson, who played mainly for Golden State, but played for some other teams, won a dunk contest back in the day.
2003.
Yeah, so both played at Michigan State, and you know had a great career there. Went to a Final Four. I don't know if he was on a championship team at Michigan State, but definitely a Final Four team. But and the reason I make that comparison is I think Jaylen Brown's kind of an uber athlete, okay outside shooter, but you know really relies more on his athleticism. I think a very bright guy. You hear about his off the court interests and went to Cal, which is a pretty strong academic school, even though he was there for just a year. But it sounds like he's a well-rounded person off the court as well. So kind of an intriguing personality, but
I also have a lot of faith. He's coached by Konzo Martin, and Konzo's known for being not only a basketball developer, but he's a man developer, right? He takes high school boys and he makes them men by the end of the time that they're there with him.
Sure, yeah, and he had him there in Berkeley, as you say. But I think Jaylen Brown still, rounding out his game, he's a an uber athlete. You see that from some of the dunks he does or some of the plays in transition. But, and that's why I kind of compare him to the Richard Jefferson and Jason Richardson. Josh, a little slip there. Josh Richardson, a good player too, but a different game. But maybe not so different than Jaylen Brown, actually. But kind of those players ended up, developing a decent outside shot, right? Richard Jefferson was more of an uber athlete early in his career, would dunk over people, rely on his God-given talents. And then over the years developed into a good outside shooter. When he was with San Antonio, he developed that corner three at that stage of his career. And then, obviously got the championship with Cleveland and, kind of was more of a higher end role player by that stage. So with Jaylen Brown, I can see him getting there in terms of, rounding out those other skills to blend with his athleticism. And, in Boston, I expected a little more out of them last year. Things kind of imploded with, from what they say, Kyrie's influence, not a good one in the locker room and otherwise. So it'll be interesting to see what they do now with, with Jaylen Brown having a little more responsibility and with Kemba Walker in Kyrie's spot. So, I think Jaylen Brown has all-star potential, but I think a little ways to go in terms of just other aspects of his game.
And then for Jason Tatum?
Well, I've seen Tatum play in person, and he's got that it factor that, that somebody either naturally has or doesn't. Like a superstar like talent. And so the names I'm going to compare him to, and again, he's not, I don't want him to say that he's there yet, but I could see him headed that direction. And one of them is Grant Hill. The other is an ex Celtic named Paul Pierce. So, I see him, having that kind of, star potential. Obviously the skill set is there. He's shown some flashes. Again, all these guys are just so young, though, and I thought Jason Tatum didn't quite advance after his rookie year last year that, that I was kind of expecting. Still a very good player, and I still think the skill set's there, and I kind of just like his, the way he carries himself on the floor. But again, with Kyrie gone, maybe that's a good thing, right? Where there's a little less, tension between those two or whatever was going on, and Tatum can kind of step up and, they still have Kemba, Gordon Hayward, so veteran guys that have been there and done that, at least made all-star teams and so on. So, we'll see if that translates to winning, but I think he's, if you had to franchise tag a player like you do in the NFL, he'd be the guy, I think, for the Celtics.
The first Celtics game going on last night, there was a really interesting moment between Jason Tatum and Kemba Walker. And Tatum took a shot, a little more aggressive shot. Maybe it wasn't, a grade-A look that they're necessarily looking for. But the first thing that Kemba Walker does is he comes up to him and says, "I don't care how much you shoot." And he said it twice. "I don't care how much you shoot. Keep shooting, keep shooting, keep shooting." That's the kind of green light that Tatum's going to need. I think Walker might be the perfect fit for him. If he can learn a little bit from Hayward, it's only going to benefit him. And Boston's such a great fan base that once he gets going, it's going to be really hard to stop him. The next name I have here on the list that I kind of put together, Sacramento boy, Buddy Hield. I mean, as elite of a scorer as we're probably going to see on this list, he's got a great just shooter's mentality. You're not really going to tell him good shot, bad shot. He's kind of just going to play, and you got to live with it. He's different from the rest of the guys on this list, as he is a little bit older. He gets classed with the guys that he was drafted with, but he did kind of go through those college years. What do you see in Buddy Hield in the next couple of years?
Yes, well, my immediate memory of Buddy Hield is seeing him play in Anaheim in the NCAA regionals, regional finals to go to the Final Four, and he just lit up Oregon at the pond, and had a fantastic game. So, saw him play those those two rounds in the regionals out in SoCal. And so kind of been intrigued by him as a talent since then. I remember Kobe being in the stands watching, and, you know, at certain points when Buddy Hield was going off, he'd glance over at Kobe in the stands, and Kobe would, like, you know, nod to him. That was kind of a cool little game within the game. But, yeah, and it's interesting, you know, he was part of a trade, you know, one of the few guys on this list that's been traded already once. I mean, I know Montrezl Harrell was traded too, but, you know, he moved from the Pelicans to the Kings. And yeah, Buddy Hield is just kind of an instant offense. You know, great shooter. A couple of names. I've got a couple of different names for Buddy. One of them is Mitch Richmond, you know, who played on the
Run TMC.
Run TMC, but also had some great years with the Kings as well. And, you know, so kind of a bigger body, great outside shooter. Always had the green light. There's another player named Hersey Hawkins that the listeners might not be as familiar with, but played at Bradley and then in the NBA with a couple teams. The Sixers and Sonics were kind of the key stops for him, but was the nation's leading scorer in college when he was at Bradley, and kind of reminded me, you know, again, his body type and the way he shoots the ball reminds me a lot of Buddy Hield. So that would be a good kind of one of those forgotten guys, you know, probably just a little shy of Hall of Fame credentials, but had a fantastic NBA career and a couple, you know, really, really outstanding seasons.
The next name that I have on the list, and the reason I put him on, is because of where he went to school. And actually, he's partnered up with a player who also went to a smaller mid-major school. And I guess at the same time as I propose this player, I'm also proposing the question of, when is it worth it committing to going to that big blue blood school, being the fifth or fourth option, versus going to a school where you're the number one guy, you get the reps, you get the looks. And that player is CJ McCollum. He's got a fantastic, aesthetically pleasing game to watch on the offensive end. The Blazers are a blast to watch when they're rolling. I mean, they can get as hot as anyone. So what do you see in CJ McCollum that we've seen before, and at the same time kind of addressing that, the college thing? You know, when is it good to go to the Kentucky, the Dukes, the UNCs, versus, you know what, maybe I can be kind of the captain of a ship?
Sure. Well, and some of it's just the evolution and where these guys are physically. So CJ McCollum is from Ohio, and, you know, from an area of Ohio that's produced a lot of good players. Although I've read and heard stories about him coming out of high school, you know, he was, I don't know the exact height and weight, but he was very small. Right? Even though he was talented and coaches would go see him in these AAU tournaments and see the talent, but just his size, you know, he looked like he was, still a middle school type player, right? They didn't project that he could, you know, get to the next level, right? And it's interesting you mentioned, the mid-major schools like Portland with Damian Lillard from Weber State, C.J. McCollum from Lehigh, of course. And then, you know, you look even at Golden State with Steph and Clay, right? Steph from Davidson and Clay, Washington State, obviously, is part of a major conference in the Pac-12, but almost like a mid-major type program within the Pac-12, I would say, right? And, one of those blue blood basketball schools for sure. And the fact that Clay was not recruited by UCLA and you know, schools like that, you know, Arizona out of high school, you know, he's from Orange County, son of an NBA player, that even those schools didn't see enough to offer him, right? And so sometimes the best thing for these guys is to go somewhere a little off the grid, right? Where, in Steph's case is probably very similar to CJ McCollum, where, you know, just physically he was small and not strong coming out of high school. And you'd think with all the talent evaluation and, you know, higher basketball minds and recruiters being able to project how someone could do, they still miss on a lot of these guys. And, you know, if Steph would have gone to a bigger school, he might not have gotten the opportunity right out of the gate, right, to play and maybe make some mistakes and have some bumps in the road in terms of learning how to play at a high level. So, you know, it obviously all worked out for those guys. But with CJ, when I watched CJ play and when he, you know, really kind of started turning it on at Portland, you know, it was really after his first year, he kind of turned it up a notch. And just that little shake and bake or shimmy that he does, that you just don't see many players do. I'm kind of going back in the time machine a little further here, and there's two players. One of them is a guy he reminds me of named Dave Bing, who's a Hall of Famer that mostly for the Pistons, but also played a little bit for the Bullets and Celtics, and a college player at Syracuse. So if you watch some footage of Dave Bing, I think you'll see some CJ in him, especially just that silkiness and little shimmy and shake and, you know, being able to elude guys. And then there's another player named Archie Clark, who played Lakers, 76ers, you know, a couple other teams, Bullets, you know, was an all-star level player, but his nickname was Shake and Bake. And it was because he would have that little move, right? That little stutter step, that little crossover type move, like pre-Tim Hardaway senior kind of stuff. Where I see that in CJ, just that, you know, and you almost miss it with McCollum, right? Where he does it so smoothly and effortlessly, you kind of almost have to wind back the DVR a little bit and say, did he do what I think he just did there? It looks so smooth and easy. I mean, do you see that with him too?
Well, the word that I was going to use with CJ McCollum was rhythm. I think he has some of the best offensive rhythm that we see in the NBA right now. A lot of guys, it's so much power, speed, force, right? I mean, our defending MVP, as we're watching, you know, Bucks Rockets right now, it's all about that, right? It's looking like a Greek god. And, well, CJ McCollum's the exact opposite. He is relying entirely on his moves, abusing aggressive defenses, and it's that rhythm. And a lot of people don't necessarily understand that when they're watching basketball, but it's the feet and the shoulders and the hips, and he does a great job of controlling all three of those things. He keeps his balance underneath him under incredibly tough circumstances. You know, you want to talk about balance, Tim, you were one of the guys to introduce me to Steve Kerr, and the first thing I asked Steve Kerr, you got any advice for a kid who's trying to be a great shooter? He said balance. I think CJ McCollum's got great balance, great feet, great legs underneath him, and I think that really benefits him in his offensive game. And I think that it's going to allow him to have a very extended career. I don't see his game fading anytime soon like I do with some of these other guys. The next player I have on the list, Tim, my co-host and I, we do a all-league pass team every year where we select five guys from different teams who, if you're just sitting down on a Tuesday night in February, you're scrolling through channels, you're watching League Pass, you say, oh, I want to watch him, or I want to tune into that guy play. And the player's Jaren Jackson Jr. He had a fantastic rookie season. We gushed and raved about him during the NBA preseason podcast. But he's got the family ties. He's got the NBA ties in his blood. What do you think about Jaren Jackson Jr. heading into year two?
Right. You're right. Another son of a former NBA player and played at Georgetown. His dad played at Georgetown and then on a Spurs championship team. So and I think his mom was also a very good player, if I'm not mistaken. But so it's always nice to have that gene pool. But, you know, and it's interesting as we're talking about these current players and comparing them to past players, I kind of see Jaren Jackson having the old man kind of game, right, where he's at least not outwardly an uber athlete. He's not going up and dunking on people. He's kind of got a, you know, low release on his shot, you know, kind of a, you know, almost like a set shot. But I really like his skill set and his versatility. And there's a player from the past, and he actually played quite a bit for the Bucks among a couple other teams, but Terry Cummings, a former NBA Rookie of the Year, who was kind of a bigger body, but could shoot the ball from the outside and, you know, and kind of had an understated excellence where, you know, he wasn't necessarily dunking over people and, you know, uber athlete type stuff, but very effective, multi-time all-star. Terry Cummings was actually NBA Rookie of the Year as a San Diego Clipper. So that's.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he's on a cover of Sports Illustrated as a San Diego Clipper. But he's a Chicago guy, played at DePaul back when DePaul was, you know, much more of the powerhouse under Ray Meyer than it is and it is now. But that's the player that Jackson reminds me of. And again, you know, the concern I have is, you know, Memphis, I think they're going to be in a rebuilding mode here for a little while. You know, they've got rid of Conley. Obviously, Gasol's been gone a couple years. So kind of the foundation of their, you know, their playoff run is gone now. So, again, they've got some young talent, some young pieces. We'll get to Ja Morant in a second. But, so I think, the potential is there, the talent's there. It's just I hope that the losing and the, you know, and that learning curve doesn't wear these guys down, right, where it's, it kind of defeats them literally and figuratively. And so hopefully that process for the Grizzlies will be relatively quick and these young guys will develop and have them challenging for a playoff spot sooner than later.
When I talk about Jaren Jackson Jr., you know, you said he's not that uber athlete, right? He's not the high-flying, fast-paced guy who's all over the map. But I think he's pretty deceptively athletic, right? He doesn't appear to be that way, but he's long. He's pretty intelligent on the defensive end, and I think that's kind of what separates him from the rest of the pack. And then we kind of hinted here at Ja Morant. I think he's got to be worth mentioning just amongst these young kids and in the game that he has, that bulldog mentality, that go-get-em attitude. Ja Morant, there has to be a guy that, you know, we've seen that kind of edge before, that moxie, that bravado in a guy that he might just kind of want it more than everyone else. What do you think?
Right. Well, kind of the current day player that it seems like a fairly obvious comparison to him is Westbrook, of course, you know, just in terms of a guard with that kind of athleticism. And although I think Morant's more of a pass oriented point guard than Westbrook is. But, you know, when I see Ja, I think of a young Penny Hardaway, right? Where,
okay,
he's got that length and, you know, and Penny was a great passer and, you know, kind of was on his way to, you know, a Magic Johnson like career, I thought. And then he had some knee injuries and, you know, never was quite the same player. But, you know, as he was on that early ascent with Shaq in Orlando, they got to the finals. It looked like, you know, the sky was the limit for him. But, you know, just physically, he would do some explosive athletic things like that. He'd make the no-look passes, you know, got Orlando to the finals, you know, pretty early on in his career. Of course, he had Shaq with him, which helps. And Nick Anderson, who we mentioned earlier in that Kevin Knox comparison. But, you know, the interesting little side story on Ja Morant. So a couple of years ago, Murray State played in San Diego for the first round of the NCAA tournament. And I happened to go down to the practices. They were open to the public and not heavily attended and, you know, kind of hanging around. And the open practices were more of kind of shoot arounds and, you know, just giving the teams and players a chance to get a feel for the arena. They would practice at some high school gym or Peterson Gym at San Diego State, you know, for a more closed, you know, prep for the opponent type practice. But anyway, I remember seeing Murray State practice, and this was, you know, again, two seasons ago, right? So before Ja blew up. And I have a pretty good trained eye, and watching them practice as well as their game, he did not stand out to me, you know, which.
Interesting.
But somehow after that season and before, you know, last college season, he blew up, right? You know, I think he was on the summer camp circuit with counselors where, you know, a lot of the NBA guys will have, you know, with the shoe companies, these kind of elite college player, you know, mini camps, you know, like a point guard camp or a, you know, a wing.
Sure.
And forward camp. So I think he really made a leap then. But as far as I saw, and I even talked to Murray State's coach. I mean, it was, again, I was kind of hanging around down by courtside, and it was kind of a loose environment and, you know, chatted a little bit with Matt McMahon just about his team. And it was that kind of a looseness in terms of, you know, that part of that you know, open to the public practice. And he didn't say anything like, hey, you got to keep an eye on this kid. You know, he's really, you know, he's going to really going to do something, right? So I was so surprised when I started reading about this kid, and how did I miss it, right? I saw, I'm usually not missing much in terms of details and players like that.
No, you're not. With Ja, though, and, the comparison to Penny and Magic, Ja's, I think, 6'3", maybe 6'4". What's he going to have to do to, kind of keep up that same pace or to continue that player comparison? Because Penny's obviously, the 6'7", and Magic, 6'9", even. What's he going to have to do to kind of maintain that pass-first mentality? Or what's he going to have to adopt?
Yeah, well, he's going to have to also be somewhat of a threat to score, right? And so the defense will, pay enough attention to him that his teammates are going to be open so he can make those passes. I know, his highlight reel from last year in college was freaky, right? All the things he do, both from a dunking standpoint, a no-look pass standpoint. So just that he had in his imagination the ability to execute some of those plays, really, really showed me a lot. So, yeah, he's going to be an interesting one to watch. And, again, kind of back to your C.J. McCollum and those other mid-majors. I mean, Murray State, that's not Duke. That's not Kentucky. That's not Kansas, right? Murray State's a little bit off the radar. And so, again, the fact that that's who recruited him coming out of high school, and sometimes that's kind of having that chip on your shoulder, and I've been overlooked, and I've got something to prove is a great way to fuel these guys' evolution into stars.
Tim, that's a wrap on my list there. I know that you brought a player or two that you wanted to bring up kind of in this conversation, so now's your time to do so. But those are my 10 right there. Thank you for that, by the way. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no worries at all. I was curious how you chose those 10 as to start. I mean, we could talk about every player in the league, but there's young players like Doncic and Markkanen and De'Aaron Fox, and there's a number of guys that that kind of catch my eye and kind of stop what I'm doing when I'm going through league pass or a games on that some of these young guys I'm real intrigued by where they're headed. Even with the Bulls, Kobe White, the rookie from North Carolina, that's another guy.
I love him. I absolutely love him.
Yeah, when you see a guy at the NBA level that seems faster than everyone on the floor, and he's dribbling, right? He's out.
Yeah.
It's like, wait a minute, these are the, most elite athletes in the world, arguably, right? And he's outrunning them while he's dribbling. So, I mean, he's still got some refinement to do as well. He's just a one-year guy at North Carolina. But I'm real intrigued by his speed. And, he's kind of like De'Aaron Fox, right? When you see how fast these guys are compared to NBA-level guys, then that's getting me to hold.
In regards to Kobe White, De'Aaron Fox has had the luxury of kind of just running his own offense the last couple of years in Sacramento. And they say, green light, go run as much as you want. But with the focus of the Bulls being Laurie and now Wendell Carter, although he's going to be hurt for the next 8 weeks, is there any concern that White's going to be kind of suppressed in what he's able to do best, which is run?
They also have Zach LaVine who can get out and go a little bit and Otto Porter. So they have some guys that can, some pace and space kind of guys. So it'll be interesting to see how they work Kobe White into the rotation. I saw he had 17 in the opener, so that's a pretty good first game on the road for a rookie. And I think, again, with a lot of these guys, you got to, kind of let it develop a little bit. Our expectations are so high it's kind of easy to get let down, even with Zion getting hurt. When else would the Pelicans have been on opening night? I guess with Anthony Davis early on, they would have had that kind of potential attention, but that's how much the buzz is about Zion. But and it's unfortunate that he's hurt right now, but there's just so much expected of these guys right out of the gate in terms of numbers. And for me, it's also winning, right? So kind of back to that original Devin Booker. Yeah, that he's scoring 40, scoring 50, getting 70 on occasion. Unbelievable shooter, unbelievable talent. But, you know, but the Suns have been dismal, you know, in terms of a winning team. So that's part of the formula that I need to really, you know, put these guys in an elite type status. You know, your guy Giannis is there now, right? The Bucks are a winning franchise. They, you know, a lot of potential.
At some point, you got to turn the corner.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think he's right on the door of it, right? I mean, if it wasn't for a guy named Kawhi, he might have gotten there last year.
Oh, that damn Kawhi guy got in our way, man. He was pretty special to watch. Tim, I think we're gonna call it a wrap right there. Thank you so much for the time. This was honestly awesome. I had a blast. I was really happy we were able to do this. I'm telling you, you know, of all the guys that I've talked to friends, I've talked to family, I've talked to guys who've played, but for whatever reason, man, you've shaped a lot of my basketball knowledge and my basketball fandom and myself as a player, not that I'm any good, but shaped a lot of it. So I appreciate you. I appreciate the help you've given me over the years, and I appreciate the time today. Thank you.
Well, Bo, since you were about 5 years old, I coined you the pocket-sized Gale Goodrich. So that's your player comparison. So the listeners can look up a Hall of Famer, Gale Goodrich, best known for his days at UCLA and the Lakers. And when I first saw you play in the Pee Wee Leagues in Encinitas, I said, that's the next Gale Goodrich right there.
Oh, man, that's beautiful. One last thing I wanted to tell you before you got out of here. So my dad texted me, said he's going to shoot 100 free throws for every Bucks game that he watches this year, right? And I mean, you know my dad and his free throws, and he's just an absolute nut about them. So he sent me this text on Tuesday. He said, Bo, wanted to get the season started early, so squeezed in 100. I haven't missed a beat. 97 for 100 today. Streak of 61 in a row. He goes, year today. So 1 year from today, in the last year, he's 1,609 for 1,700. He has not shot a lot of free throws, but he does have his statistics since 2009. Since 2009, my dad has shot 66,200 free throws. He has made of those 66,000 free throws, 61,777. That is a 93.31% clip. Today, as he knew that we were prepping for this and he knew you were coming on, he might have been the most excited of the three of us for this. He said, if you can squeeze it in, mention to Tim, I shot 100 free throws today to commemorate the inaugural podcast with you two. Shot 94 out of 100, just surpassing his 93% clip. He wanted me to let you know that.
That's great. Well, and I can be a definite witness that those numbers are not at all exaggerated. I pride myself on being a pretty good shooter, and you know, I'm kind of more in the 88 to 92 out of 100, you know, on a typical day. And any time in my life that I've gone and shot free throws with your dad, I have to resign it myself to the fact that I'm going to come in second that day, no matter what. So, many guys can go out and make 90 out of 100 and be the loser.
Yeah, it's a, I'll tell you, growing up with it, it's not too much fun either. You know, at 13, 14 years old, when I was making 80 out of 100, thinking I was, you know, hot stuff, my dad's putting up 94, 95 with streaks of 61 in there, right? And it's maddening to work with, but it's pretty special. Thank you, Tim. I really appreciate the time.
Well, Bo, I love all the work you're doing with all your broadcast mediums and, you know, the news broadcast, the podcast. So, you know, keep it up. I love your energy and your passion for sports, and happy to be part of it, and would love to be on with you anytime.
I appreciate it, Tim. Hey, get back home safely and take care.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Bo.
Tim Gallagher, I'm telling you guys, there's no bullshit when I talk about this, and Tim is just a great guy. He's just as true of a basketball mind as I know, and there's no denying it. He's been coaching guys. He's been working with guys. He's been meeting people. He connects the dots unlike anyone else that I know. He is the best basketball mind. He is the reason honestly, I might be in the place I am today. So I'm very thankful for the help that he's given me, and he has been a great friend of my dad. And almost every night, man, when I go home and I walk up to that front door, there's always a stack of paper or an article or a sheet or a photo with something circled on it, and it's special, man. It's a pretty unique little basketball community we've created in La Costa Valley of California. Thank you, Tim Gallagher, for coming on. I told you guys, it's hard to keep up. The guy knows his stuff. Well, that's it. Thursday, an hour later. Well, oops. Oh, well, it happens. Another episode of The Bo Templin Show.
And here is Vince Carter with his first stop.
Let's go home. Let's go home, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go home.
What can I do for you?
I got something to say.
There's nothing better. Say what you gotta say.
I don't know if it'll make any change, but I figure it's time for me to start playing ball.
I told you once I got rid of him.
One other thing. I play, coach stays. He goes, I go.
Look, wait, coach is dismissed by a vote of 68 to 45.
I think we should vote again.
Yeah. Call for a revote. All those in favor of the coach staying, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Nay.
Coach stays.